The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of Track Wrestling, along with Andy Ice Cream Cone Hamilton. And what would you know? We have a double guest show today. We have Mike Moyer, Executive Director of the National Wrestling Coaches Association, and our chance to say goodbye to Justin Tritz, the founder of Track Wrestling, who is leaving his current role, will still be involved in the company, but he will no longer be with Track Wrestling. And exciting times right now for us, Andy, because we get to break down the best dual meets of the Dynasty Duels. And it's been a lot of fun for us, but I'll tell you what, some people are taking things personal. This is all fantasy, and I look at video games and I look at other fantasy products out there, and it doesn't seem like they take it as personal as what's been going on here. And I just have to remind people that this is all fiction, this is all fun, and why wouldn't you just be happy to learn more about the sport? It's a great historical tool, and that's my little rant about some of the people that are a little upset that someone tech-falled someone that likely wouldn't tech-fall them. It's all fan voting, so why not just sit back, why not enjoy, and just have a great time learning more about Division I collegiate wrestling, Andrew?
I'm with you, Kyle. I'm with you. I like the ones where they ask, like, what our criteria is when the criteria is listed in the graphic on the post where they're asking what our criteria is. That's one of my favorites. But that and the people that complain that didn't actually vote. So.
Yeah. I mean, hey, Little Mac certainly can't knock out Mike Tyson, and he can in a video game. And Bo Jackson probably can't rush for as many yards as he does in Super Tecmo Bowl, and you could go on and on. But why not just enjoy this? It's never going to happen. Absolutely. Do I think that Tim Krieger would get mauled by Jason Nolf, even though the results showed it that way? I don't. But you know what? Maybe more people know about Tim Krieger right now and did a little homework and learned more in his bio, and we've made him more relevant. So why not just embrace that part of it and learn more about the sport? Because some of these people, probably young kids today, don't know anything about him, Andy, and maybe we educated them, and that was our goal.
Well, I think when we started this project, we knew that the teams from the 80s and 90s were probably going to be facing an uphill climb in most cases. Now, there are some guys like the 97 Iowa team, which has some all-time stars like Lincoln McIravey, Mark Ironside, Joe Williams. You know, maybe those names are familiar enough with, you know, household names that have carried on here 23 years later that are still in fresh in the minds of people. Whereas 87 Iowa State, like, I don't think they got enough credit in the voting. That was a good team, and there are some legendary stars in there, as you mentioned, Tim Krieger, and I think Eric Volker lost his match in the Dynasty Duels. I think Stuart Carter only scored like 14 or 15% of the vote. So, yeah, they're facing an uphill climb. But there's still some teams like 91 Iowa, 92 Iowa, that they probably carry in a little bit of push from the Iowa fandom that, you know, they're going to be hard to beat. Be interesting to see how this pans out, because I think that whichever eight teams we wind up with in the quarterfinals, wouldn't shock me if any of them won the entire tournament.
Well, and a couple of things on that. Of course, with that 91-92 Iowa team, they're both identical. So if they meet in the finals, they're going to have to face off against each other. So that could be interesting. But also, the names are still relevant. Brands, Steiner, Ryan, we've talked with them all. And then you go up to Ostendorp, he's the head wrestling coach at Co. So there's some names in there that are familiar. But admittedly, there's some flaws in this, in that when you see Mark Ironside on the voting, you're just thinking Mark Ironside could beat Frischkorn. Well, he might not that season. Frischkorn plays fourth and Ironside plays sixth in the year that they went against each other. So people probably aren't digging that deep. So that's one of the flaws that might be part of this. But again, it's still fun and you get to learn these names. And even for me personally, it's fun to dig back into those and realize there's some guys in the lineup that I just didn't realize were in the lineup, and you get to learn these intimately. So it's just been a great historical lesson, and I've had a blast being part of this. This is a great thing, and it's not over yet, but kudos to you and Richard for coming up with this idea, and it's really been a good thing for track wrestling.
What's been the most enlightening fact that you've forgotten about through the years that this has refreshed for you in your mind?
Absolutely, the 1986 Iowa team with that deal at 118 pounds. No question about it. Like, I knew about it a little bit, and then I had to get refreshed on that because it just was a hole in my memory. And the Iowa wrestler there just was absent without leave. He just left the team before the Big Ten tournament. So they didn't have anyone at the Big Ten Championships. They tried to get Steve Knight down to wait. And talking to Gable about this, he went through it and he said, if I would have had more time with him and just had him prepared, he would have been down to wait. But it was a last second call and Steve Knight tried to make it down. But they're trying to fill a spot with a guy that was a returning finalist from the year before. And just to miss out on that opportunity and to have no one there, that was really fascinating to be able to get that history from Dan and learn more about that. So again, that was part of why this is fun, is to learn why these things transpired and how things shake out. Because you forget sometimes, you forget how lineups go, and you see that with 86 Iowa having five champions, the first time in the history of Division I college wrestling to have five champions. And then they have eight All-Americans, really an iconic team with a lot of guys that went on to Division I coaching jobs. But to have Matt Eglund skip out before the Big Tens and learn about that history, it was pretty fun.
Can you imagine if that had happened, like if something like that happened in today's era, social media, the internet, like how crazy a story like that would be?
You're right, man. I mean, it would be everywhere, and especially if it was in Iowa. If it was another team that he missed weight or didn't show up, it might not be as big. But if it's the University of Iowa and it's a returning finalist, that would just be huge, right? Like in the era of the internet, it would blow up. But now it's one of those anecdotes that you learn about and you bring up again after several years, and you learn about. But how about you? Anything that struck you as interesting?
Yeah. 1992, Troy Steiner. I did not realize how dominant his national tournament was. He went 15-0 in the first round, won a five-second injury default in the second round, 15-0 in the quarters, 15-0 in the semis, 8-2 in the finals, added up 53-2. Kyle, he didn't even win the OW. Tom Brands was the OW that year.
Yeah.
I can't imagine someone having a tournament that dominant and not winning the Outstanding Wrestler Award, but obviously Tom had an incredible tournament too, beat Alan Freed in the finals. So that was one that my memory of Iowa wrestling in the early 90s is not super sharp, but that was one going back and looking at it, I was like, whoa, I did not realize Troy Steiner had that dominant of a national tournament in 1992.
And then another one to add to this, Andy, is that I think that the two most underappreciated, underrated Hawkeyes are, we've talked about Eric Juergens, but I feel like Marty Kistler gets no love. Two-time champ, yeah. Three-time finalist at three different weights. So he's at 150 in 1984, loses to Kenny Monday, who ends up being an Olympic gold medalist. Wins it in 85, wins OW in 1986, two-time champ. Nobody really talks about this guy. And then to add on to that, his sister Darcy is a world-renowned ballerina and probably more famous than any of the Kistler brothers who wrestled at Iowa. So just an incredible story that I don't think gets brought up enough, because Marty Kistler, man, he's two-time champ and one of the forgotten Hawkeyes. So I'm glad that his name gets to be back into the fold.
1986, Marty Kistler, Kyle, 14-6 in the first round, 21-8 in round two, 20-4 in the quarters, 9-3 in the semis, 15-3 in the finals.
Man, that's good enough to get you OW, man. So I hope people learn about him and learn about his story, because it's a remarkable run. And you'll see other Kistler brothers in there. We had Harlan placing third in 1983, and then Lindley was second and fifth. So Kistler brothers were an important part of the Iowa program, and don't think they get brought up as much. They have a great legacy, and it's, again, this is a great reason with these dynasty duels that you get to learn about these guys and they get their name back into the fold. So it's been a lot of fun. Next thing that's been in the news is a potential change here with the Hawkeye Wrestling Club. You, Andy, had an interview for 45 minutes with Tom Brands about what's transpiring, but looks like a few changes at the University of Iowa in their club system. Can you fill us in on how that conversation with Tom went and what we can learn about what's going to happen with Iowa wrestling going forward?
Yeah. So, Tom informed me or confirmed to me that, the big story of the week, right, is Mark Perry is leaving the Hawkeye Wrestling Club. Sounds like going to Arizona State. Nothing has been confirmed from the Arizona State end of things yet or from Mark Perry, but it's what the word was from Tom Brands. Piece two to the puzzle came about 24 hours later when Thomas Gilman announced he was going to the Nittany Lion Wrestling Club. Still remains to be seen what's going to happen to the women's freestyle stars of the Hawkeye Wrestling Club, but Tom Brands indicated that they're going to be following Mark Perry out to Tempe, so we shall see on that one. But as far as Tom Brands was concerned, the words out of his mouth were all positive about Mark Perry, what he's brought to their program, about Thomas Gilman and how much he will be missed. But Tom sounded at peace. He sounded at peace with all of this. You would wonder how he would be handling a situation where you lose basically all of the key cogs of your Hawkeye Wrestling Club. Your four world teamers of a year ago. Allie Reagan, a two-time world silver medalist on the world team last year. Kayla Miracle, U23 world silver medalist on the senior world team last year. Forrest Molinari almost made the world finals last year. And then Michaela Beck was in the junior world championships. And if they indeed follow Mark Perry and leave and go to Tempe, certainly a blow to that program on the women's side. I mean, it takes away, 100% of what they had going on there on the women's side. Thomas Gilman, two-time world team member, has been in Iowa City for 8 years, Iowa native, three-time All-American, 2017 world silver medalist, one of the favorites to make the Olympic team at 57 kilograms, Hawkeye through and through. To have him leave, there are a lot of people that, a big portion of the Iowa fan base that is kind of hurting right now that these guys who are Iowa alums are, leaving the program and vital parts of that Hawkeye Wrestling Club. But, we saw it in the fall with Kyle Snyder leaving the Ohio Regional Training Center, going to the Nittany Lion Wrestling Club. And you look at it from Gilman's standpoint, and right now just aren't a lot of colleagues in his age group in that Hawkeye Wrestling Club. Whereas you look at the Nittany Lion Wrestling Club, he's been on world teams with Zane Rutherford. He's been on world teams with David Taylor, with Kyle Snyder. Nick Gwizdowski comes through there from time to time. You know, he's been on overseas trips with Bo Nickel. You know, Thomas Gilman's been around a lot of these guys, been in training camps with a lot of these guys. So that and his fiance is a Pennsylvania native. So it's one that's, you know, if you just look at it from a surface level, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around with all these moving parts. But you dive into it a little bit and understand maybe some of the motives and why some of the things are going on. And it's a little more understandable.
With you covering Iowa wrestling for so long, dating back to your first wrestling interview with Doug Schwab back in the day, what has the Hawkeye Wrestling Club meant to Iowa fans? Has that been an evolution and how important that's been to Iowa wrestling from your standpoint?
You know, it's one where it's kind of had some peaks and valleys in terms of, you know, I don't even know how to put this. Like, I don't want to say in terms of popularity, but importance probably is a better way of putting it. When I got in there, when I started covering the beat, it was December of 1999. Midlands was the first event that I covered, and you had Doug Schwab, returning national champion. He wrestles in the Midlands finals against Mark Ironside, who was with the Hawkeye Wrestling Club at the time. Trying to remember what else. Like Mark Ironside was in the Midlands finals. Yeah, Joe Williams was still training. I think, you know, Lincoln McElravy was still with the Hawkeye Wrestling Club at the time. There were several others that were still, I want to say maybe Mike Mena was still hanging around then. There were a handful of elite contestants, like Olympic hopefuls, going into that 2000 trials period. And it was up and running pretty strong for about, I would say, wouldn't you say about 15, 20 years prior to that point? Like the Kurtelmeier, yeah. Gable and the Carver family really got that thing rolling when? Like early 80s, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it was founded in 73, which would have been during that that Carver, Kurtelmeier, Gable era. But you're right, I think it was rolling into that 70s, 80s, especially with the 84 team where Gable was the coach. So I think that was really the apex right there.
And you had moments then, like if I'm not mistaken, where Iowa could have like a national championship contender in its college lineup, and they were like second or third best guy at their weight class in that practice room at the time. Like it was Hawkeye Wrestling Club was like two deep at every weight with guys who were national championship caliber wrestlers.
And guys would come in. I mean, even thinking about the era that you had mentioned, I mean, I think Eric Aiken came over. I think Bill Zadek was still around. So I think you still got guys from other programs, like a Joe Corso from Purdue came in, and I think the training environment was there where other teams would come up and train with the Hawkeye Wrestling Club. So it certainly was rolling there for a long time. And of course things change and now you have RTCs and the dynamic has changed, but it really has been a crucial part and probably the premier program for a while. And I'm sure Tom wants to get back to that and have an arsenal of guys. And I would assume that it's going to be led by Spencer Lee at some level.
Yeah, so to follow up on your question, Kyle, like my perspective of the Hawkeye Wrestling Club, I would say, like, you know, it started to, you know, after McElravy, after Ironside, you know, it started to, like, maybe the roster started to dwindle a little bit. I mean, they had such a high-powered team in 2000, 2001, and then Juergens, Stripmatter, Schwab, I think were around for like 1 year, and then they all went different places. Schwab went up to Minnesota. Juergens and Stripmatter started Young Guns Wrestling originally in Michigan before Eric and Jody split and went back to their home states. Eric in the Quad Cities, Jody out where he grew up out in Evansburg, Pennsylvania. And then there was a moment, you know, several year stretch there where the Hawkeye Wrestling Club really didn't have much of a presence on the senior level. When Tom Brands came back to Iowa, that was one of the first pieces of the puzzle that he put in place, was trying to really ramp that up again. And they started having some success again with right away, Mike Zadik, 2006 world silver medalist. Doug Schwab made a world team in there, finished fifth in the world in 2007, made an Olympic team. Both those guys represented the United States at the Beijing Olympics in 2008, and the Hawkeye Wrestling Club has had a stronger presence since then. But it's going to be interesting to see where they go from here to replace Mark Perry. And there's some, you know, names that kind of cross your mind a little bit right away. But, you know, Tom Brands said, we're not going to stay stagnant with this thing. And he said, we're going to be better off, not because we're going to get somebody who's better than Mark Perry, but because we're moving forward. So eager to see what the Hawkeye Wrestling Club looks like going into this next Olympic quad once we get past the Tokyo Games.
A compelling storyline that we will continue to follow. We have some storylines coming up with our first guest, and that's Mike Moyer of the National Wrestling Coaches Association. What do you say we get to him and dig into the college scene, Andy? Our guest is Mike Moyer. We've had him on before. He is the executive director of the National Wrestling Coaches Association, and it couldn't be more timely to have him on with everything that's gone on. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, in a very real way, I've articulated this to you before, but not to the level of the weeks after, but I am still buzzing from the multi-divisional national duels, Mike.
Yeah. There's some great wrestling there, for sure.
It was. And just to explain why, again, it's just the team concept, and there was just this energy. And for me personally, I didn't think I was going to be able to go. And then Andy said, hey, do you want to hop in about a few days before? And I was a little jealous of Andy that he got to go without me. And so to be able to go to that, and I hadn't been to a national duel since it was with the Dome, and just to experience that, it was a great thing. So I hope you'll keep it going.
No, we sure will, and we're looking for ways to see if we can build on the success we've had. And even when you think of dual meets at the Division I level this past season, there were just some epic dual meets where you just have these wrestlers just having at it at every weight class. And I can't think of a better way to keep wrestling relevant in the school and in the community than through those exciting dual meets. So we'll keep at it.
Mike, thinking of the current landscape and where we are, Old Dominion just dropped wrestling, but from our vantage point, is there anything that the media can do, specifically track wrestling, to be proactive or to help the cause?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, one of the things that they had a consultant, you know, come, you know, on campus and over a period of months was doing, you know, anytime that happens, you know, something's going to get cut. But there were a few things in that report that really sort of stuck out. One was the exact words were that Division I wrestling is dying. And when you really think about just this year, that this season that we just completed, we had our first ever Division I men's and women's wrestling program at Presbyterian College down in South Carolina. We had our first ever NCAA Division I wrestling program in Arkansas, completed its first season at University of Arkansas at Little Rock. We have a brand new Division I program, Long Island University, which migrated. You know, that's a program, a Division II program we started 4 or 5 years ago, and the entire athletic department has decided to migrate into Division I. We have three other Division II schools that are migrating into Division I. Two of the three we've started in the last 5 years, Cal Baptist and Bellarmine University in Kentucky. And Augustana, program that's been around a long time at the Division II level, is also migrating to Division I. You know, we have two brand new Division II programs that we started for next year, Wheeling University and Glenville State, both in West Virginia. We have six new Division III programs that are established for next year. We have 11 new women's programs at NCAA member institutions. And unfortunately, I'm not at my office, but I know we have, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of a half a dozen new NAIA men's programs coming online. And so we really have a lot to be thankful for and a lot to celebrate. I was also looking just before the interview here, you know, we have two brand new women's NCAA programs in the last week at Aurora College, a little Division III school out in Illinois, and Augustana College, another Division III school out in Illinois. So we're at 254 new college wrestling programs just since the year 2000. We can now say that more than half of all the college wrestling programs across the country have been established just since the year 2000. And so to your point, what can the wrestling community do? We need to make sure that we're telling that story beyond the wrestling community. We're pretty good at telling it to each other, but we really need to do everything we can to anytime we're around key decision makers at the high school level or the college level, we need to make sure that we're sharing those speaking points. And thank goodness we have track wrestling, you know, doing interviews like this to help reach that broader media market. And so, again, a lot to celebrate. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, as terrible as this crisis is that we're currently in, it's creating even more opportunities for us to add programs. Because what's happening is these college wrestling programs at all levels, these institutions at all levels are really hurting for enrollment. And wrestling is so attractive because we have this huge population of high school participants and a limited number of college opportunities. And it's not a very expensive sport to start. So what I'm seeing now, which is very encouraging, is we're even seeing a growing number of Division I schools that are interested in taking a page out of the Division II, Division III, and NAIA playbook along the lines of, could we add sports in order to help with our enrollment problem? And you can imagine now in this economic mess, you got situations where mom and dad might be unemployed, and that's going to put even more of a challenge on these colleges to maintain enrollment. So we really have a great story to tell, but we need to be telling it to these college administrators that at schools that don't have wrestling. To your question about Old Dominion, we have a very, very strong wrestler and business network that's been established down in the Norfolk, the coastal Virginia region, with some really impressive business leaders. And we've been able to mobilize the business community down there. We're just notified on Friday that we're going to have an opportunity to have a conversation with President Broderick at Old Dominion. We're really hopeful that our business community down there can not only help him find an alternative strategy for keeping the wrestling program intact. But I'm confident that our business community down there can help President Broderick solve challenges that he might have that extend way beyond maybe even the athletic department. Because one of the things that's near and dear to most college presidents is the concept of employment for their college graduates, you know, and careers. And with some of the iconic business leaders we have down here, in a perfect position to help President Broderick solve that challenge. I mean, every college and university president wants to say, hey, come here, because when you graduate, we're going to help you with your career because of this network of businesses that support our college community. So I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, as you know, it's a challenge once a decision like this is made to eliminate a sport. You know, more often than not, we're not successful, but we are successful enough to justify throwing everything at the kitchen sink in trying to save a program. And with the business leaders that we have available to us down there in the Norfolk area, I'm cautiously optimistic. And there'll be an opportunity for the wrestling community to help us. We just need to get through the first couple steps of conversation so we can be a little more specific on what the community might be able to do to help us. The one thing for sure, though, is whatever we do as a wrestling community, we always want to take the high road. You know, we certainly, as frustrated and disappointed as we are when we communicate our thoughts We just want to make sure we communicate them in a positive way. And when things get really negative, that typically, it almost never helps us. And usually it does more harm than good. But there'll be more to come after we get past the, you know, this first conversation and we have a little bit clearer picture of what needs to be done.
Mike, when you go through a situation like this, and in particular with Old Dominion, can you kind of lay out your timeline of what it looks like for you personally and the initial action steps that you go through and how you combat this, how you fight for wrestling?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of our primary strategies, quite frankly, to protect the college wrestling programs we have is through a new operating program or division we have within the NWCA called Wrestlers and Business Network. And if you ask me, what is the number one most important, most impactful thing we could do to protect, particularly the Division I programs we have out there, I would say it's to organize a group of highly influential business leaders in and around every Division I program we have. Because at the end of the day, in every community, there are business leaders that are just so influential. You know, the last time we were in this situation was when Cleveland State announced that it was dropping its program. We have a very strong and powerful wrestler and business network in Cleveland. And, you know, that decision was rescinded in a matter of about 9 days because of the influence that we had. So to your question, the first thing that we do is we reach out to the most influential business leaders we have in a community, and we assess who's got direct access to the president, who's got direct access to the athletic director, who's got direct access to powerful politicians. And we mobilize that group and we get on a call and we just sort of fact find, you know, because a lot of times the stated reason isn't always the real reason. So when you're trying to formulate a strategy, it's good to, you know, make sure that we know everything that went into this decision. And, fortunately, Coach Martin did a wonderful job down there of mobilizing the wrestling community and that business community. And thankfully, we have access to these very influential business leaders. And as I said earlier, not only are they in a position to help save this wrestling program, but they're in a very important position to be able to help President Broderick solve many other challenges that he undoubtedly has, many of which probably have nothing to do with athletics. So that's kind of where we are now. The next step will be to have a conversation with President Broderick and get some clarity as to what the possibilities might be that could help get this decision turned around, and also get a better idea of what some other challenges that he has that our wrestling community might be able to help solve.
Michael,
So that's probably the best update of where we are right now. And one of the things I'll say about Old Dominion is clearly it falls into the category of a tuition dependent university. And that's one of the encouraging signs we're seeing, that more and more of these Division I schools are becoming very, they're struggling for enrollment. You know, Division II and III and NAIA have certainly, the need for them for enrollment has come a lot sooner, but we're really seeing more and more of this at the Division I level, and wrestling can help them solve their problems just like we've helped it solve 254, you know, Division II and III and NAIA and women's programs, you know, in the previous 20 years. So that's, hopefully that answers your question.
When, administrators throw out a number figure, a dollar figure for what they need to save a program, it always makes me a little kind of queasy where I think, you know, are we going down a path that we start getting held hostage by schools because they want wrestling to step up to the plate and fund their program like that? How do you combat that? How do you approach that scenario?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Well, we always promote the fact that the healthiest programs are really the result of a three-way partnership. It's and those three partners are the institution itself, the alumni, and kind of the wrestling friends. And it's really important that all three of them sort of come together and understand the importance of the partnership. The truth of the matter is, though, the more that all of our college coaches can strive towards endowing their programs, the less likely these decisions are to ever happen. The challenge with trying to endow a program is that the cost prohibitive part of it is typically the scholarships. And, you know, at the Division IA, at the FBS level, you know, at the Power Five conference schools, they have a lot of television revenue, which really helps these athletic departments, you know, fund the Olympic sports. But when you get to the kind of the group of five and the mid majors and the lower level, you know, lower tier Division I programs, they don't have the television revenue and they don't have the football and the basketball ticket, tickets for games, you know, the revenue from that. And so it's much more challenging for these athletic departments to be able to maintain broad-based Olympic sport programs. And so as a result, we need our college coaches working with their alumni, working with the business communities in their regions to do everything they can to do their part to assist the university in this partnership. And, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, one of the unintended consequences of self-funding these programs is it plants the seed in the next administration's eyes. Oh, why don't we do the same thing? But clearly we take the position. It needs to be a partnership and the school needs to be doing its part as well.
I like Andy's line of thinking there, because I just think of the University of Northern Iowa, which is just a couple miles from where we live. We're out of Cedar Falls, Iowa. And I just think about how they had to crowdfund just to get a new wrestling mat. And with this current environment, and you think about, hey, we're getting slighted, should you feel slighted or should you just feel thankful that you have a program and you do whatever it takes?
I think it's the latter. I think that the sooner, even though it's unfair, maybe it's unfair that some of our wrestling programs have to do more to endow their programs or cover their operating budgets through alumni and friends than maybe some other sports. The upside to that is it just does that much more to insulate our programs from being dropped when something like this happens. We just think of it as we have a head start over a lot of the other Olympic sports. The thing I want to say here to really sort of frame the issue, because I think I'm going to share a couple numbers here that really put this into perspective. So there's about 350 Division I athletic departments in the country, but about 120 of them are what we call FBS, football bowl. So these are, you know, the Alabamas and the Penn States and, you know, the Power Five conferences, the ACC, the Big 12, the Pac 12, the SEC, the Big 10, and then the group of five, Conference USA and the MAC, those conferences. So there's 120 of those athletic departments across the country. And these are the 120 that supposedly have all the money. And last year, it was estimated that about 30 of them, actually, of those athletic departments, turned a profit. And the remaining 80 of them lost an average of $21 million, meaning the institutions have to subsidize to the tune of $21 million each year to make ends meet. But that's assuming that these institutions are maintaining their enrollment. If their enrollment drops, it's getting harder and harder for them to subsidize the athletic departments. And again, this is an average of $21 million. So some of them a little bit less, but some of them more than that. So that's the first set of numbers I want to put out there. The second set of numbers is the Division I schools were expecting a $600 million allocation from the NCAA this year. You know, all the Division I schools would get a piece of that based on this formula. Well, instead, because the basketball championship was canceled, they're going to get a piece of $225 million. And so obviously that's a really big differential. And so when you realize the average athletic department's being subsidized $21 million as it is, and then something like this comes down the road, you can begin to see the value of a sport like wrestling that has a relatively large roster size that could really help a school with its enrollment problem. But what I don't know, and this is a question for our wrestling community, is there an appetite out there for us to consider something along the lines of what football has? You know, football has a non-scholarship level of football. I'm not really advocating for a non-scholarship level of Division One, but maybe there's a place for a reduced scholarship level of Division One, where you could group these programs together according to you know, likeness of funding, where they could have a level playing field within their conference, still qualify for the NCAA Division One championships. Because based on the conversations I'm having with boards of trustees and with college presidents, they love the idea of helping the enrollment problem with a sport like wrestling, but they're not excited about the idea of chasing a business model where at the end of the year, the institution is subsidizing the athletic department by $21 million. And at the mid-major level and the lower level at the state schools, it's a student fee issue. So a lot of the athletic departments of a mid-major Division I program are funded with student fees. And what's happening across the country is student governments now are starting to have an exception with the growing student fees. So there's tuition, room, board, and student fees. And actually in Virginia a few years ago, the student governments of the state-funded schools went to the state legislature, and actually there's now a cap on the amount of student fee money that can be used to fund the athletic departments, putting even more stress on public schools in Virginia that are trying to maintain broad-based sports programs. So I think it's something we should think about. You know, generally speaking, from a strategy standpoint, we want to bring our underfunded programs up to the level of where our best funded programs are. And, you know, there's no doubt about that. But given the economic model out there and now the effects of this coronavirus, there really could be an incredible opportunity for us to take a page out of the playbook of what we've been doing Division II, Division III, and NAIA, and helping more and more Division I schools solve an enrollment problem with more moderately funded Division I wrestling programs.
It's interesting, Mike.
That's a lot to digest. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, you're laying out a scenario in which wrestling comes out of this with more programs rather than fewer, which I think is a concept right. That's for a lot of people hard to wrap their head around, but you know, you lay it out there in the way that it could transpire. But you know, with that in mind, Mike, like, you know, you look through this and I know in the past you've talked about, like, it's easier to add scholarships once a program is in place or once a you know, it's easier to do that kind of stuff when you've got a program in place rather than adding a program back,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So if we took this concept a little further, and let's just say you're coaching a team that's in one of these moderately funded conferences, that's not to say that if the coach is really entrepreneurial and at some point down the road, he gets a $5 million endowed gift to endow the scholarships. There's nothing to say that wrestling program has to be in that moderate funding category forever. You could always elevate yourself out of there into, you know, another conference where programs have better funding. But it would give us an opportunity to keep growing the base while we look for opportunities to get institutions to add better funded programs. But based on those numbers I put out there, it's a tall order right now. You know, it was a tall order before the coronavirus hits. You know, now it's really a tall order to think that any Division I university is going to add an Olympic men's sport that just contributes to this deficit it grows every year.
Mike, you mentioned trying to get programs endowed. Are there any D1 programs that you can say are solid? Like, I've heard Oregon State is endowed and they're solid. Is Iowa solid? Is Penn State? Are there any programs you can say, scratch them off the list, they're gold?
Yeah, but the ones that are in the best position are the ones that are at one of those 30 FBS athletic departments that are turning a profit. You know, schools like Iowa and Penn State, and yeah, I really don't want to name it because, you know, I don't have a comprehensive list, but, you know, when you think of the Power Five schools where the athletic department turns a profit, you know, those are the ones that are the safest. But there are also Power Five conference schools that I think definitely have Olympic sports that could be in jeopardy, because not every Power Five conference athletic department is flush with cash. But they are in a better spot, certainly, than the Group of Five. And what I've learned with the Group of Five schools is many of them are really sort of the enrollment, you know, the declining enrollment is becoming more problematic. You know, that's certainly, from my experience, not a problem at most of the, in fact, I've never come across a Power Five conference school that's struggling with enrollment. But when you get to the Group of Five and you work your way down from there, there's a lot of opportunity to sort of leverage wrestling in the same way we've done it at Division II, Division III, and NAIA, if we have an appetite to do something like that.
Mike, we've talked in the past about the challenge with conference affiliation right now and some of these teams coming into the Division I level. How much of that is exacerbated right now with, you know, trying to limit travel costs and things of that nature?
Well, that's a really, really big problem. I mean, even before this hit, you know, we have Cal Baptist that we have not been able to get into a conference. And in fairness to the conferences, you know, our conferences have been very, very good in the past about accepting affiliate members. But there's a limit as to how many they can take. And there's also a lot of politics. Sometimes it's not in the hands of the coach. It gets to the administrative level. You know, you start having conversations around branding where you have a Power Five conference and the athletic directors or presidents sitting around a table and they get a little bit squeamish about accepting affiliates that might not be from Power Five conference schools. But I can tell you that one of the biggest threats to our ability to continue adding new Division I programs is trying to get new programs into a conference. And we also have Augustana University in South Dakota. As now, it's got a 4-year waiting period, you know, before it'll be eligible for Division I. But, you know, we've been trying to see if we could help them get into a conference, and that's been a struggle. And so the last thing we want to do is get a school excited and get a brand new Division I wrestling program ready to launch, only to find out the final hour we can't get them into a conference. And so the NWCA just submitted sort of an annual report to the NCAA Wrestling Committee, and that was one of our top priorities. You know, can we work together to figure out some type of a solution to help these new Division I programs that for one reason or another can't get into a conference as an affiliate member? And it's a really big threat to the incredible momentum that we've had behind the growth of Division I.
Of course, everyone has questions about the NCAA championships and what that looks like. They ruled that they will not grant eligibility for these athletes going forward. Mm-hmm. Who makes that decision? Who's behind that? Is there a committee? I think a lot of people want to know who are the names that make that decision, mm-hmm. and how that came to be.
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of times you hear comments like the NCAA, you know, the NCAA is not empathetic, or the NCAA should have granted another year of eligibility, or that sort of thing. What's important for everyone to know that these decisions are primarily made by committees that are comprised of of administrators from NCAA member institutions. So they're made by college presidents and college athletic directors, you know, with input from NCAA staffers, but the decisions are really made by the administrators from the NCAA member institutions. So there's something called the Division I Council. And it's comprised of, you know, high level administrators and conference commissioners. So that committee is working, gets input from a lot of different subcommittees. And, you know, clearly the challenge around granting another year of eligibility for the winter sports was just the enormous cost. You know, just, you know, obviously when they granted that for the spring sports, it added enormous costs. You know, but we all know, those of us that have coached, we just know what our wrestlers have dedicated their entire lives for that opportunity to compete at that NCAA tournament. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking that, you know, it didn't happen. And, but at the same time, as you can imagine, these administrators are dealing with extraordinary challenges, maybe greater than any challenges they've ever had to deal with in the past. And it's trying to find some kind of a balance in there, which is easily, you know, easy, not very easy to get to. And that's where these decisions are coming from.
So there's no chance that this could turn and Spencer Lee, Mark Hall, whoever you want to name, will have their chance at adding to their legacy.
Yeah, I mean, I've reached out to some high profile administrators and sort of tested the waters. There doesn't seem to be any appetite. You know, and you know, just based on, you know, in large part, the financial implications of doing so seems to be the you know, the biggest obstacle to getting something like that in place.
Mike, one of the things that I was wondering about with this was, you know, like, why couldn't they offer the athletes a chance to come back, like, kind of as walk-on status and let them make up their own minds? Like, do you have any idea why that wouldn't be an option in play?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, that's a very interesting. I was not in the room when those conversations were going on, so I don't know if that came up or not. But that certainly. You know, seems like it could have been an option.
Any chance that they grant official All-American honors to the top seeds?
Yeah, we had submitted a proposal for that, and that was denied. And it really didn't get into why, other than we did get official notification that that was denied. We were trying to at least help these athletes bring a meaningful conclusion to the season. And our Division I leadership group, actually, you know, this was discussed at every level, but the Division I leadership group put a lot of thought. We had a lot of conversations, a lot of conference calls, and we had submitted a proposal asking for that. And unfortunately that was not granted.
Where does this land in the scope of things that you've experienced? I mean, you have a wide swath of experiences here. Where does this fall in the kind of just total craziness that you've experienced?
Well, you know, 2008 was an interesting time, but I would say it doesn't compare to this. You know, this is what's so challenging about this is it's easier to get through things when you have certainty. And the challenge with this, there doesn't seem to be much certainty. So it's hard to plan for anything when you really don't have certainty. And that's whether it's, we're thinking about things from a National Wrestling Coaches Association perspective or just from the intercollegiate or the interscholastic wrestling perspective, there's so much uncertainty that it's really just hard to know what's going to happen. What I do know is this, you know, tough times don't last, but tough wrestlers do. And we have no intention of taking our foot off the gas pedal. You know, there's tremendous opportunities out there right now. And, you know, we want to take advantage of those opportunities. And so we have no intent to run and hide and just go dormant. You know, we our phone's still ringing. College presidents and athletic directors that want to start new teams. We've actually, from a coaches association standpoint, we've had a few really important infrastructure things that we wanted to do, but it was hard to do when we're going 100 miles an hour every day. And we've been able to do some of those things. And you know, at the end of the day, it's our plan to come out of this thing even stronger than when we went in. But there's certainly a lot of uncertainty out there. And you know, we can't wait for things to become a little more certain.
But Mike, the uncertainty, isn't that fun? That's what you said is the best part about dual meets, that should be uncertain.
That's true. But, you know, certainly from a planning standpoint, I don't know that the uncertainty and the outcome of a wrestling dual meet, you know, is kind of a different kind of uncertainty than the uncertainty of trying to, you know, plan from a fundraising standpoint or sponsorship standpoint or those types of things. But what we are certain about is that we'll see our way through this and we'll come out stronger on the other end. And it really does afford us the opportunity to focus on some of our sports challenges. You know, I mentioned earlier, one of our challenges is conference affiliation. Another area that we've really been focusing on is this is the first year that there's been an academic component added to the NCAA revenue share formula. So long story short is athletic departments have like an academic average. It's comprised of how all of their sports teams do. And if they meet this minimum cut point this year, they stood to gain about $50,000. Now, I don't know with this pandemic if this is going to impact that at all or not. But by year number three, it's the amount of money an athletic department could gain was in the neighborhood of $250,000. And it continues increasing from there. So we want to be very careful that we never have a situation where we have a Division I wrestling program, which is the reason its athletic department missed out on this money. So we've been working with a Deloitte consultant over the last probably 12 months. And we've essentially developed for internal confidential purposes only, like a report card on every college wrestling program we have. And it's not just a health check on the wrestling program, but we also can do like an overall health check just on the institution itself. How big is it, its endowment? How much financial aid money does it allocate based on the size of the endowment? We really get an idea of how healthy the institution is as well. And so we're in a much, much better position now to be able to identify our more vulnerable programs and be able to help them in a proactive way, rather than waiting till an announcement comes that the program's being dropped and then scramble around and try to figure out how to save it. So there's a lot going on sort of behind the scenes, but I'm a big believer in the old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And, you know, we have really, really good data. And it also helps us when we go to get a new program started. We get, you know, we don't want to be maybe allocating a big startup grant to an institution that might academically not be sustainable. So we have we're in a really, really good spot with regards to protecting and strengthening the wrestling programs we have at every level. And this little downtime we have has really sort of given us an opportunity to finish some of these projects that we've been trying to do as we're going 100 miles an hour. And that's been a good use of this time as well.
Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us again and informing us and keeping us educated. And again, if there's anything that we can do on our end to really help promote programs and really bring awareness, please let us know. But we appreciate your information and being so proactive.
Well, thank you. And we'll be back to you real soon in this Old Dominion situation. This is, you know, failing can't be an option on this. We need all hands on deck, and we're going to need the entire wrestling community at some point to help us. But we're just trying to get a little more clarity on the situation before we do that. But we'll be back to you real soon.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you. Bye now.
Before we get to our next interview with Track Wrestling founder Justin Tritt, just want to follow up with that interview and just digest some of the information that we just heard, Andy, because I think there's so many good things there that you can glean and take away. But I just think the concept of being fully endowed is really important here. And John Smith had articulated that in an interview a few months ago, in that he had a decision because he had someone that wanted to make a donation. And his thought was either you can put it into facilities or you can endow it and have that for the future and fund coaches. So I think there's really some thinking here right now that you probably want to steer more toward the endowment side of things in a lot of ways. So as we take that Northern Iowa example and just saying, maybe we get an endowment so that every 7 years or however long mats are take place or however long they wear out, that you're able to do that and not have to crowdfund for a mat. So I just think there's some good talking points there that Mike gave us.
Well, think about this whole situation, right? I mean, I wrote at the beginning of the season how college wrestling was in the best shape that it's been in, like, in 30, 40 years. I interviewed Mike in the fall about this, and actually I think those were his words, not mine, but looking at it with all the numbers that have been, you know, the number of programs that have been added at the lower levels, we're seeing Division I programs on the uptick, and all of a sudden, like, wham, this thing hits us and we don't have a national tournament and we're losing Old Dominion and wondering if there's going to be a college football season. And if there's not, what does that mean for college wrestling? And boy, it's just, you sit here and think about it and it's like anything you can do to anchor down that will help you in terms of long-term stability, it makes you really rethink things a little bit right now.
And I like the way that Mike thinks, though, because he didn't come on here and have doom and gloom and say, hey, we are probably going to have 10 programs drop by the end of this. I think he was going the opposite way and saying this is an opportunity. So I really did appreciate his line of thinking there and how we can use this as a rallying point and really move forward and try to get more programs than we thought possible.
It's a hard one to kind of wrap your head around, right? I mean, in terms of the current climate, and we're seeing, you know, what's happening with the economy and also in the athletics economy, and, you know, to think about adding programs right now, it seems, the first time he threw it by me, I'm like, where is he going with this? And then the more, like, I started hearing the plan and how it would work, I'm like, you know what? Like, I can see a path there. I don't know that it's going to happen, but it's an interesting thought, though. And it's one that you know, wouldn't have crossed my mind.
Well, we have a guest that took wrestling to another level coming up, and there was a lot of things that probably didn't cross a lot of people's minds, and Justin Tritt's revolutionized the sport as we know it, and we're in a different space, and we are employed, Andy, because of the incredible work by Justin Tritt, and you can speak to that because you've worked with him a lot longer, but we're going to talk with someone that has really changed wrestling forever.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, let's get to Justin. Our final guest is Justin Tritt. He is the founder of Track Wrestling, and he has stepped down in his current role, but we're glad that we have an opportunity to have him on the mat so we can pay tribute to all his contributions to wrestling and to us. Justin, thanks for joining us today.
No problem at all. Glad to be here.
What are you doing next? Let's just go right to it and find out why you made this decision to step down in your current role and what your next plans are.
So I guess that those would be two different questions. I guess I'll go to the what's next one. And the easy answer to what's next is probably that I'll be spending more time in the development area, in the electronics arm of Track Wrestling, which is a separate business. It's being rebranded as Edge Sports Technology, but it was TW Clocks. And as some people might know, TW Clocks was the business that was responsible for building the score clocks that integrated with Track Wrestling, did some more work with vibrating buzzers for officials and building video kits for sale for Trackcast, and sort of manages the electronic side of what's going on with Track Wrestling. And it's sort of like the development, innovative, exciting stuff that I like to do. So I'm going to spend some more time focusing on that area of what we're doing. I've actually got some pretty exciting stuff coming, which I don't think I'm ready to let the cat out of the bag on what it is yet, but there's going to be some really cool stuff coming at the start of the next season from that area. And then I'm actually also going to launch a website. So I'll have there'll be another website out there doing some other stuff, just basically using my skill set to continue to be involved in the wrestling space. And I mean, really back to the first question, I guess, is why I stepped down. It goes back to what I'm going to do now, right? It's I want to be immersed in development and doing the things that really excite me, that I feel like make a big difference in the space. And, the truth is managing Track Wrestling, although it's a lot of fun and there's a lot of good things that come out of it, it's not what I went to school for. It's not what I was passionate about. Like, management isn't my passion. My passion is development. So it's a way for me to sort of move on to that.
Is it gratifying changing the sport for you?
I mean, of course. I mean, I believe that a pretty successful thing that I went through, and that sort of as a group and all the people that have been involved have developed. And so, yes, I mean, it's extremely gratifying to know. I firmly believe that it was successful and it did have an impact on the sport. So that I take a lot of pride in that. And I also think, we've gotten Track Wrestling to a point where it is self-sustaining. We have so many great people involved, as you guys are obviously involved, and know all of them, but there's a lot of great people filling a lot of important roles that are now able to sort of take the torch and carry it, and not just carry it, but continue to add fuel to it. So that's pretty exciting. I'm looking forward to watching that and, being a big fan of it, while still hoping to contribute from the sidelines or from a side business. So,
Justin, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the entire story of Track Wrestling, can you take them back to the beginning, how it started, how it originated, where the idea came from, and what you thought that this could become back in, 2003?
Yeah, 2003. I mean, the original idea is the simple, I want to be able to have a virtual seating committee, done by a computer program with seating criteria that can seed a tournament, and not have the best guys in the Wisconsin State tournament meeting in the first round. And I mean, that was the initial idea. That was when I sat down and programmed my first thing. It was, how am I going to set up criteria that somebody can specify and allow them to put the wrestlers in, put the criteria values for the wrestlers, and get an output that is, hey, here's where these wrestlers should be seated. And everything that happened after that was a snowball of, well, if you're going to do that, you should do this. And if you're going to do that, you should do this. And we'd really like to see this added. And it was just a huge snowball with a lot of work behind the scenes in order to make the things happen that people wanted to see happen.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but you were going to school at the time to be like a math teacher or something, weren't you?
Yeah. Yep. I was actually in school in La Crosse when I initially started programming this. I was maybe a junior in college. And Yeah, I was going to be a math professor. I needed to take a minor in order to for my major, and decided to minor in computer science, and took one class, absolutely loved it, changed my major. And the rest was, you know, I just fell in love with computer science. So
where along your journey did you realize that you did have a mind for mathematics and this thinking?
I think it was that first computer class. I mean, up until then, I was honestly terrible on computers. My freshman year of college, just trying to type a paper and save it to a 3.5-inch floppy was like, you know, that was a challenge for me, or not a challenge, but like, I didn't know how to do that. And then when I took that first class as a junior in college, it was so intriguing. And like anything that is intriguing and you're passionate about, that you really, really just want to learn, like it allows you to get good at it. So it was the kind of thing that our teacher would give us a homework assignment, and I would do the homework assignment and then figure out how that applies to something else I wanted to do and expand on it and go write my own stuff to, for example, manage my finances. You know, like, hey, I'm going to write something so I can better keep track of, you know, how much I spend here, how much I spend there, all that kind of stuff. So, like just things like that, that I enjoyed. So
did wrestling ever capture your imagination like this did?
Did wrestling?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Wrestling was, you know, my sport as a kid. Like, I obviously did some other sports, but wrestling was my sports life. By the time as I got into high school, that was my focus. All of the extra work I was doing in the off season, wrestling, lifting, running, it was always with a focus on getting better for wrestling. The truth is that the work ethic that instilled in me, I applied almost daily within track wrestling, because when I would get up and go for a run, or get up and go lift for wrestling, or I was, you know, trying to work while other people are sleeping, that kind of mentality is exactly what I applied to wrestling, to track wrestling. There was a lot of nights where I'd work long into the night, knowing I had to get something done in order to, you know, get something out or beat somebody else to the punch, or get up early knowing, hey, you know, most people wouldn't want to do this, but I'm going to do it because I want to make track wrestling the best it can be. And all of those things I would look back on, hey, if I wanted to be a great wrestler, I had to do this, this, and this. If I want to create a great program or, whatever, get this business, I have to put the effort in. So I think wrestling helped me tremendously.
When you're trying to grow something, there are challenges that come along the way. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced, and how did you get through them with this?
I mean, every innovative thing was a challenge, right? Like from the just getting results online and dealing with servers and trying to make sure that when the mass of people first came to the site to start looking at results, that the site would be available and up for people to check out the results, and, you know, people running events on those same servers, trying to make sure that they're not impacted by the traffic of some other tournament or their own tournament, the public trying to get on and view the results. You know, things that most people probably wouldn't think about, but are a serious challenge when you're, you know, first learning about this stuff and trying to put something like track wrestling out there. So you go all the way back to just dealing with trying to make sure that you had a website that could handle the traffic, to integrating score clocks, you know, basically trying to find the next thing that could be done in order to improve the efficiency of managing events and then implementing it. And every single time you roll something new like that out, there's challenges. There's things that it's challenging to build. And then there's things that you don't see that all of a sudden you're like, oh, I didn't think about that. Now it's a problem we got to deal with, and we have to deal with it and fix it by tomorrow because that tournament is starting tomorrow. Or it's this particular situation caused an issue, and now we got to fix that particular issue. So, I mean, technology is an interesting thing in the sense that you have to do a lot of planning in order to launch something and a lot of work to get it out there. But then, you know, when it hits the real world and all of a sudden people start using it in ways you never expected them to use it, you run into challenges. So, I mean, it was constant challenges. There wasn't a day where we sat back and thought, oh, we got this, we're done. So
take us through your decision to sell the Sports Engine and what went into that.
I mean, it was getting to be so consuming that I saw no light at the end of the tunnel for being able to manage it all and keep up with the demand and sort of the longevity of the system. It needed to go somewhere where a company could invest more into it, get more people on board to help support it, and really just help get more of the work done. I've never been a big gambler. So I wasn't going to take, my finances and probably didn't even have enough finances to get it to the point that it got you through Sports Engine NBC. But I mean, in the end, the goal was to, help get someone to help carry the load because the load was getting way too heavy. And honestly, Sports Engine NBC did a fantastic job of doing that. You know, I think it's been almost 4 years since they acquired us or since they acquired Track Wrestling. And I mean, I'm obviously to the point where we're talking now where, I'm actually able to just go focus on something that I'm really passionate about. Not that I wasn't passionate about track wrestling, but like my just personal passion of, computer science and technology, and know that it's in good hands. People can manage it. Know that as many organizations, as many tournaments, as want to use the system can use the system. They can handle all of that work. If they can't handle the work, they'll hire more people to handle the work. It's really nice. And it was really important to get to that point.
What will you miss most about your time at Track Wrestling?
Honestly, it's, building the new cool things that you release and people are like, wow, that made a huge difference. We really enjoy that. And most of the time when I was developing those things, it was with Tommy. Tommy Marocca, for anybody who doesn't know, is the lead developer now on the Track Wrestling platform. And, we spent a lot of time together, meetings every morning, a lot of time working on projects, and, I really enjoyed it. And that's what I'll end up missing the most.
What was it about Andy Hamilton you'd like to hire him as the content manager?
Well, I think Andy was just a professional. Like from the moment I met him, he's been a professional person. Shane Sparks, who worked for Track Wrestling at the time, highly recommended him. I have a lot of faith in Shane, trust him a lot. He talked about how Andy was so great. And Mike Moyer, also with the NWCA, who I have a ton of respect for, knows a lot of people in the sport. When I talked to him, the first name he mentioned was Andy Hamilton. So there was two very credible people in my mind who were like, hey, this is a great person. And all of the conversations that I had with Andy were, you know, he impressed me. And looking back, it was the best decision we could have possibly made in the media space. I mean, I'm not just saying that because now I'm on the phone with Andy and in this interview, but I really believe it's made a huge difference for track wrestling. We had no media presence until Andy came along. And now I believe that we're a leader in the space. So that's pretty awesome.
Is Shane Sparks crazy?
Shane Sparks is awesome. I mean,
but is he crazy?
He's not crazy. Shane Sparks is passionate. He brings passion to whatever he's doing. I mean, he's an example of just the great people we have in the perfect role within our organization. Like Shane Sparks there's nobody better. You couldn't get someone better than Shane Sparks in the role that we have him in. And not only does he do that role, but he's also willing to fill in other places that he has the skill set. where we might need somebody. And I mean, he's a rock star.
Yeah, he's awesome, man. I mean, just keep elaborate maybe on his energy, because it's pretty legendary. The guy just kind of like you, he just knows how to have a motor and just keep going forward, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you can't get on a phone call or have an interaction with Shane Sparks that's not memorable. Everywhere he goes, people get to know him very quickly. And I mean, if you don't like him, I don't know what to tell you. We're probably not going to be friends, because if you don't like his energy and like what he brings to the table, even if you disagree with it, I mean, he's a fantastic person to have and be around. He's a energy of the party. I mean, he's everywhere he goes.
Well, take us back to that, Justin, how you and Shane linked up, because he was running what, Badger State Wrestling at the time, and been.
So Shane Sparks, the first time I got to know him, he was running a video website in Wisconsin called BadgerStateWrestling.com. And honestly, anybody that knows Shane knows he doesn't have a lot of technical skill. So he made that website work without people really knowing that he didn't have any technological skill, just because of the passion and the energy he was willing to put into making it successful. And I got to know him through that. And as I got to know him through that, I saw exactly what I just said, is that he basically was running a business successfully, that he was a technology business and he wasn't very good at technology. I mean, he was just a hustler. Like, he worked so hard. He would be the one putting that time in, staying up late, getting up early just to get stuff done, make sure it was done right, make sure it's done professionally. And he ran that website for a long time, and we got to know each other really well. We went to Packer games together. We'd go on trips. He'd be announcing for USA Wrestling. We'd stay in hotels together, stay in the dorms out in Fargo together. And I got to know him really, really well. And he was just at a point in his life where I think he wanted a change. I think the weight of trying to run a website and put that kind of effort into it, when technology's probably, it wasn't his thing. He would openly admit that, I'm sure, and move into something that he was really good at and passionate about, which was advertising, sponsorship, announcing, like anything that has to do with relationships. And he wanted to do it. It fit in perfectly to what we were doing. And it was another one of those hires or people that are part of our team that's just like, man, he fits in well.
How will you stay involved on the actual wrestling part? Are you going to coach and be involved in youth wrestling?
Yeah, I mean, personally, that's my passion from like a non-business perspective. I love coaching youth wrestling. So I coach the youth program here in Wisconsin Rapids. Recently purchased a building here in Wisconsin Rapids, did some renovations to it. I'm still doing renovations to it, but it's called the Beast Cage. Basically we can have open wrestling and wrestling practices and things like that for kids from around the area, like basically all over central Wisconsin. They come to Rapids and we've got, you know, an area, a lounge for parents to hang out, and we're putting in locker room showers. So it's, the goal is to make it a great facility for kids in central Wisconsin to be able to come in and train with each other and elevate the level of wrestling in central Wisconsin. So, that's like a, just not a business from any perspective. That's more of just like, hey, I love doing this. I really want to give kids an opportunity to wrestle and compete. I'm sure I'll be putting free time into that, because it's just a lot of fun.
Justin, thanks for taking time and sharing your story again and filling us in on what you're going to be doing next in your life. And again, we appreciate you so much and can't thank you enough for providing us this platform and letting us have great jobs that we get to love and have passion like you do. So our thanks to you for filling a big role in our lives and being a big part of what we do.
No problem at all. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Thanks so much, Justin.
great way to finalize this show with Mike Moyer and Justin Tritz, get a good history on how the company got formed and where we're going as a sport. Can't say much more than that, Andy. It was fun to be able to talk to both of these guys. One is exiting his current role, and Mike Moyer still on the path to getting us more programs, and he believes he'll do it, and I believe he'll do it, and I think you do too. And it was fun to get both guys on the call.
Yeah, always, right? And we've had Justin on the show. I think it's been at least a couple years, but and the story of this company and what he has done in the sport, it's pretty incredible. I mean, I think of how much I used track wrestling as a resource before I got to track wrestling, and I couldn't operate during a season without it. Now, when you think about where we were 20 years ago, pre-track wrestling days, and God, I don't know where we went for statistics. I think we waited for our amateur wrestling news to come out each month to get box scores, right? And that was about it.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. And then maybe you could go online and hopefully an SID had some information there, but it was scouring the internet and trying to find things through just paper results. So feel fortunate that we have this great resource. And then to add to it, just the video content in the library there is just unprecedented. So just feel honored to be a part and that we get to recognize Justin in such a great fashion. So we will miss his role that he was in, but we will certainly stay in touch with him. It's been a lot of fun, Andy, for Mike Moyer and Justin Tritz and Andy Hamilton, of course. I'm Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.